All right. So Tom asked us to talk about experimental results primarily, but anyway, results on flow effects, nonlinear flow effects in entangled polymers. So let me just preface this by making a couple of remarks. One is that in some ways the tomorrow and today might have been reversed, because some of what we're going to do is compare data with some nonlinear models. I assume they're going to be discussed tomorrow, so I'm actually just going to show results and not equations, and if it's appropriate tomorrow, I can say, all right, well, that was the model that showed this or showed that, but I think it's inappropriate to spend a lot of time talking about the model right now. Jim and I split. Jim was once my graduate student, and we're still working together, so we split what we're going to talk about into two parts. I'm actually going to talk about some collaborative work that was primarily done with Tam Sridhar, who was here until this week, and is concerned with chain stretching effects primarily in extensional type flows. And Jim is going to talk about some real optical work in transient shear flow primarily. What I'm going to say today, and what Jim's going to say too, is concerned with monodispersed solutions, polystyrene solutions primarily. I'll tell you more about them in a bit. We are currently working on more general things in my group. Amy, who's here somewhere, is working on stars in a similar way to what we're doing here. And Kim, who's sitting next to her, is working on blends. And so we have some further work that I'm actually not going to talk about. I should also say that Tam has other extensional rheometry work on similar generalizations, too. So let me, I wanted to write, just say a couple of general things before I show data about essentially trying to work on flow effects in entangled polymers. Now, the first one basically has to do with data quality in some ways. My view is that the data, whether it's rheological, rheo-optical, or other things, once we add significant flow effects, is likely to be more difficult to get, and therefore is likely to be less precise than linear viscoelastic data. And in many cases, shear being the notable exception, and in some ways the extensional rheometer also falling into that category. But other than that, if you try to do flow, you end up having to study both polymer dynamics and fluid mechanics simultaneously, because the two are coupled in a way that means that you can't just assume that you know what the velocity gradient is doing without measuring it. So you actually have to do both things typically. Another little editorial comment before I start, in a way, is that at least it's our view that it's essential to study more than one kind of flow. Shear is an interesting flow. It's the favorite of rheologists, as we all know. But there's a lot of other flows, and a lot of them are quite important. And the thing is that, in a way that I'm going to delineate slightly more in a second, these different kinds of flows, departures from shear flow, can introduce basically fundamentally different effectiveness, if you like, in terms of the kind of deformations that you can produce in something like a polymeric liquid. As a consequence of that, a lot of effort has actually gone into developing so-called flow classification schemes, including some work that we've done, not all of which has necessarily been paid much attention to, I might add, so maybe it's not as important as what I think, but anyway, I'll mention a little about this. The thing about shear flow that makes it both extremely interesting and perhaps not the thing that you would necessarily want to spend all your time studying is that it's a very special case. And as I say, and I'll indicate why I say this in a second, it's a sort of singular limit. So when you add perturbations due to relaxation, or you introduce transients or whatever, in shear flow, they're likely to play a much more profound role in some way than they are in some of the other kinds of flow that people would be interested in. I think when you see the kind of data we have in the comparison with different models, you'll see partly why I'm saying that. So just mention briefly this flow classification thing I'm sure you're all familiar with. If you think of steady, spatially homogeneous flows, there aren't many of those, by the way, but if you think that you have such things, then the fundamental difference between shear flow and almost every other flow is essentially the way that material points separate in time. In shear flow, depending on the relative alignment of these two points, you find algebraic separation in time. But perhaps even more importantly, you find that there's a sort of asymptotic orientation of anything. So I say hydrodynamic particle, but think of polymer molecule or anything else, which as some hydrodynamic so-called aspect ratio becomes large, leads to alignment with the velocity, namely alignment orthogonal to the velocity gradient. Whereas in all these other flows, the asymptotic orientation direction is in a direction that still leads to non-zero components of strain rate in the direction of orientation, which means that material points in these flows aligned in this asymptotic direction separate exponentially in time. And so there's an enormous difference, if you like, in the potential of these different classes of flows to produce stretch, essentially.
Gary?
Yeah.
Isn't it possible, though, if you do exponential shear flow, you still do affine separations that are exponential in time, right?
You can do affine separations of material points in time until they start lying, you know, but you can't get rid of the alignment part. But yes, you can do exponentially changing shear rate type experiment. If you start thinking about time-dependent flows and you're still worried about close flow classification scheme, things get a lot more complicated. So here's three papers that have disappeared into something or other that we worked on, which indicate some of the richness, essentially, of trying to think about how things stretch and orient in time-dependent flows and to what extent you can carry forward simple ideas like the ones I had in the previous view graph to time-dependent situations. In any case, I'd be happy to hand out reprints of these, by the way, if anybody likes. I've got quite a stack, by the way. You might not be able to find this one, actually. If you want that one, I might have to. Chaos, Solitons, and Fractals. It's a famous journal, by the way. So anyway, the conclusion from all this is that the deformation of polymer and shear flow is a very special case in which the dynamics of stretch is a very subtle reflection, essentially, of orientation dynamics, and they're coupled in some critical way, which is not actually as true in almost every other flow. And so in some ways, shear is the most difficult case. It's also probably the most interesting in the sense that you're most likely to get complicated time-dependent transients and things like that. And probably it's also true that if you get everything about shear flow exactly right, then with the possible exception of trying to model the degree of chain stretch, which is not very severely tested by most shear flow experiments, if you can get the shear part right, you're likely to have a pretty good chance of modeling most other flows pretty well. The two sets of experiments that I'm going to talk about, experimental results that I'm going to talk about, are two. One is the extensional rheology experiments of Tam Sridhar and his students. And I just am flashing up this picture to remind almost everybody who was here last week about those experiments which Tam talked about. And I'm not going to really tell anything about details, but the basic idea is that in this system they can measure both a stress and a strain rate, and from that they can calculate, and they can pull this out, by the way, to a sufficiently high strain that they can actually get to a steady state, and hence they can measure something like an extensional viscosity for these systems. And then in our lab we do tend to do rheo-optical experiments, although we have conventional rheometers at least in our lab. And we use different flow devices to produce different kinds of flows. Since they're optical experiments, we typically do planar flows, ranging from purely extensional flows produced in a so-called four-row mill to so-called mixed-type flows produced by these co-rotating two-row mills. Jim will talk about work in a Couette device for simple shear flow. All right. Now, so our interest basically is obtaining data in these systems and then trying to make comparisons of data with model predictions. If that's going to be useful, a key question then is parameter estimates, and it's actually one that, as some people here know, we've been struggling with for a long time, trying to get it optimized as best we can. So in our system, in our way of thinking, I guess, we tend to think of the entanglement molecular weight and a relaxation time scale as the critical parameters. We use basically literature correlations to estimate entanglement molecular weight for the polystyrene solutions that we're using. I'll show you what they are and what solvents they're in and so forth. Depending upon the concentration, we either do or don't try to take into account polymer quality effects. These correlations are set up in such a way that you get the entanglement molecular weight for a melt of 13,300, which we take to be the right value for polystyrene. You might argue with that, but... And by the way, these have in them, all of our parameter estimates have in them the famous 4/5 that was discussed last week also. What?
The good solvent is that result with the square root on the volume fraction of polymer is notoriously wrong.
For a good solvent?
For a good solvent.
I said for a theta solvent.
For a theta solvent, it's wrong. That's where theta solution theory fails completely. So if you use that, you should probably want to...
Well, we don't use it much, actually, because most of the solutions we have don't fall into that category.
Lucky you.
You know, one could test sensitivity of what I'm going, you know. So what we end up doing basically is fitting, essentially is setting the parameters in the entanglement molecular weight, and from that, the number of entanglements per chain and the plateau modulus. We take those as fixed and then use linear viscoelastic data essentially to determine relaxation time. The only thing I can say about this is that if you look at the ultimate values that we get for things like the plateau modulus and you compare them with estimates that you would make by any of the other ad hoc rules and regulations that people have derived, they all lead to basically the same, something similarly close, not sufficiently different that it would make a difference to the comparisons I'm going to show you. And basically all agree and also agree with what we've gotten from this methodology. So the more difficult, from our point of view, the more difficult part is the one about relaxation times. I'll show you the linear viscoelastic data that we have. It tends to be reasonably low frequency data for various reasons. The way we think about the time scale question is the following. We view the longest measurable relaxation time, or the terminal time, as a model, well, not view it, it is a model independent quantity that we can try to extract from our data, assuming that we have adequate low frequency data. Given that value, we can estimate a corresponding reptation time. That does turn out to be model dependent, because if you think about the terminal time as applied to or interpreted by a model which doesn't include either chain length fluctuations or diffusive constraint release, then the terminal time is interpreted as the reptation time or the disengagement time. If you start adding other features to the model, though, for example, if you add chain length fluctuations, then the terminal time is lower than the reptation time by some factor that depends upon the degree of the chain that relaxes essentially by chain length fluctuations. And you would estimate a larger value for this disengagement time. If you add, which we haven't done in what I'm going to show you today, but if you were to also add diffusive constraint release, that puts in another factor which is smaller than one and produces a further increment in the interpreted value, if you like, of the reptation time given the measured value for the terminal time. So I'll come back to that and show you what effect it has. But what it means is that our view of this is that if we're going to try to use some particular model for comparisons with nonlinear data, then what we should do is to use the value of the parameters that are consistent with that model in the linear viscoelastic limit, right? So it means that if we take, say, the so-called DEMG model, which doesn't include chain length fluctuations and doesn't include diffusive constraint release, that we should interpret basically the reptation time or the disengagement time for that model as being the terminal time. On the other hand, if we're going to make calculations with a model that includes chain length fluctuations, then we should use this quantity that I called tau d2 up here. And if we were to do calculations for a nonlinear model that also included diffusive constraint release, we should do this. We haven't done that yet, but we're in the process. Anyway, what I'm going to show you today does not include the diffusive constraint release. So the materials that we've looked at, or the ones that TAMA's got data for that we've been looking at, are a series of polystyrene solutions in different solvents, but the main point here is that they have a number of entanglements estimated, as I indicated before, ranging from about 6, so not, well, hardly entangled, up to a maximum value of about 40. Let's see, what else do I want to say about that? I guess that's the main thing. Oh, I should have pointed out, there's two different molecular weights here. Most of the data is for a 4 million molecular weight solution, which has a manufacturer's posted polydispersity index of 1.05. We also have one set of data, some data for a high molecular weight system, which is more polydispersed. Notice that that higher molecular weight system and this lower molecular weight system were constructed in such a way that they were supposed to have essentially the same number of entanglements per chain, but different molecular weights, because we thought that was interesting. So here's starting with the not very entangled system. I'm just going to flash up some sets of data and corresponding model fits, essentially, that are the basis of choosing relaxation times that I'm going to show you in another table in a second for these various solutions. Okay, so that one is. The data down here, by the way, is probably spurious. You can probably knock off a few data points. These are very low stresses. This is also an extreme, this is a quite dilute solution, so we're not going to get too much out of that. But if we look at some other ones, so here's the one that had about 14 entanglements per chain. You can see some discrepancy here, which is bigger or smaller depending on the particular solution, and probably is due to the fact that this linear viscoelastic model that is being used to draw these lines doesn't include diffusive constraint release. It just includes chain length fluctuations, basically. And, well, I'm not going to bore you with these, but anyway, there's a series of them. One thing you might be interested in, though, is the comparison between that one and this one. So this is the 4 million 10%, so 26 entanglements per chain, supposedly. Here's the more polydispersed one, right? The 10 million 6%, supposedly the same number of entangles per chain. And you can see the clear signature in the increasing discrepancy between the model without diffusive constraint release and the one with it when you start adding polydispersity to the system. Okay. We have, as I said, we haven't taken at this point the diffusive constraint release.
We don't believe that diffusive constraint release will make up all
that. Well, that point was made last week. Actually, the point Tam made in his talk last week was that if you look at, for those who weren't here, is that if you look at solution data, whether it's this data or you start looking up data in other people's papers in the literature, this thing of having essentially a flat plateau and not dipping down, even when the number of entangles per chain gets pretty big, seems to be symptomatic of solutions. And Tom tried to make a suggestion last week as to one possible way of thinking about that from a theoretical point of view, and Tim, who's, I don't know if he's here, but anyway, Tim claimed he thought it was because of polydispersity effects, essentially, and so I think it's an open question, but it's nevertheless true that, you know, if you look at solutions, everything else is consistent with a certain number of entangles per chain, and so forth and so on, but you always find this flat plateau. You never really find the data dipping down.
So Gary, your model fits should they have two adjustable parameters?
They, well, as I said, they were, no, they were done by fitting, they by assuming that we knew the entanglement molecular weight for the solution, Z, et cetera, and then just fitting a time constant. And basically, the fit was primarily done in the low, you know, it was just done looking at the low frequency, this low frequency data, that's all.
Can you solve this question if you have calculated the time scale rather than fitted?
I don't know. We haven't tried to do that, but I'm not sure.
That's a dubious business. I mean, it's not just solving Zimdrag, right?
You know, maybe you could get, well, you can certainly compare solutions with solvents with different viscosity, perhaps, if you think the solvent quality is the same and so forth and so on. I don't know. I mean, there are correlations, by the way, for these relaxation times for polystyrene and other solutions. However, and you might ask, well, why, you know, we used a correlation for figuring out entanglement molecular weight and so forth, why didn't we do that with the time scale as well? But if you start reading the especially recent literature about people's efforts to estimate time scales from linear viscoelastic data, the most recent paper I saw from Osaki had something like a factor of 10 variation depending on how he chose to fit certain data, by what methodology and so forth. So our view was that we were probably safer to try to, at least in this case, if we decide that something's not right about what we've done, we can go back and fix it without too much pain. So anyway, resulting from that is are these relaxation times. And the only reason there's two things I want to show you about these. So here's essentially an estimate of terminal times for these solutions. If I think of the DE or DEMG model, then I interpret terminal time as the reptation time. I calculate a Rouse time as being a factor of 3z smaller. So that's what this is. If I interpret the terminal time using a model that has contour length fluctuations in it, I get a larger value, right? As I said before, that's these values. Calculated 3z smaller for the Rouse time. Notice what's over here, by the way, is Gracely's the result from Gracely's correlation for polystyrene solutions. And these numbers are generally all larger than these numbers. This is for the Rouse time, all right? So these numbers are larger than these over here. My view is that the difference essentially is diffusive constraint release plus perhaps some other mechanisms, but at least diffusive constraint release. In fact, I didn't list the list here, but Alexei actually has taken our data and fit it with his model that includes diffusive constraint release. The values that he gets, apart from this low concentration solution, are pretty much equal to the values that come out of the Gracely correlation.
So how did you get this Gracely correlation?
It's just published. Menenzies and Gracely. You just take the formula and calculate it. Yeah, I just took the published correlation and calculated numbers to see whether they were qualitatively consistent with what we were getting.
So, can you say a little bit more about that? The correlation is just a formula for the Rouse time.
Right, precisely. Yeah, exactly.
How did they get this?
By looking at linear viscoelastic data, like, is all I can, you know. I don't know. It's not a new paper. It's published in
81.
Yeah. So. Oh, Ralph did this.
Fluctuations increase the terminal time.
No, not the terminal time. So this is the fixed measurable longest relaxation time. But it does, but so the difference between this number and this number is due to contour length fluctuations.
If you're going to use a model that has contour length fluctuations, you have to use a tau d that's going to be higher such that you add the mechanism that's going to be.
Otherwise, you don't get the linear, you know, you don't get the low.
It's kind of hard to get the vectors on time, you didn't fix it all.
So tau d is the fictitious time if there was no fluctuations, just pure rotation.
Yeah, exactly. That's precisely true. Yeah, that's true. I think that's true also. Actually, I'm not going into all this. We've actually looked at not only Milner-McLeish version of contour length fluctuations, but Massoy's earlier one, and we've looked at various versions of convective constraint relief, so I might add also, although I'm not going to go into that too much. So, now, take those constants that I've just flashed on those view graphs, take measured data for the extensional viscosity for one of these solutions. This happens to be the broad molecular weight distribution one, which is probably not the best choice for this demonstration, but anyway. So this is the data. The data cuts off at a fairly low strain rate, primarily because when we were doing this, we had in our mind that we wanted to study the chain stretching part of this more than anything else. In retrospect, it would have been nice to try to get a few more data points to the left here. I've pointed out over here to the value that one would expect to get in the limit of zero strain rate if you take the measured zero shear viscosity and multiply it by 3. And of course, it's a little lower than what any of the models that I'm going to talk about predict, because the models do not include diffusive constraint release, which would cause these curves to shift down in the low strain rate limit. So what's on here? What's on here? So I'm going to talk about this one in detail, and then I'm just going to show you quickly some other ones.
That's confusing, because the models did a good job of putting the terminal behavior and the linear viscoelastic data, and I would have thought that was what dominated viscosity in the interval over frequency, and therefore that you ought to get the Troutman number right.
I think the reason is they've not mapped in physics from the linear model over into the nonlinear model. I take it.
Let's say, if you run a nonlinear model in a linear regime, would it agree with linear MacLeish? If you run a nonlinear model in a linear, in a very small oscillation, right? You can always.
Yeah.
This curve shows that they wouldn't agree.
Yeah. Actually, we didn't do that, so I'm not sure, to tell you the truth. We didn't actually take the nonlinear model and try to do that calculation, to tell you the truth.
That's the linear limit, right?
Well, no, I thought you were talking about taking the model and trying to do directly the linear viscoelastic data, not this.
But one indication is that you can get this question.
Yeah, I suppose you can think that way, yeah. Okay, so what's on here, first of all? This curve, this blue curve, is the DEMG model and nothing else. So no contour length fluctuations, no diffusive constraint release, but with a model built in for chain stretching. That's the blue curve. The yellow curve, let's see, which way I want to go. So the green curve, let's say, that's above it, well, above it over here, is the same model, and it wouldn't matter whether we did Doi-Kuzu or Milner-McLeish, the same model essentially with contour length fluctuations put into it and nothing else. So it shifts the low strain rate extension of viscosity down. Keep in mind that as you add relaxation and you therefore have a less aligned system, that reduces the extension of viscosity. And so as you add relaxation, you go down in this region. But because adding contour length fluctuations leads to a different estimate, essentially, of the Rouse time, of the Rouse time, a larger one, right? Then the upturn to chain stretching, as calculated here, occurs earlier. So that makes sense in that respect. This curve represents, well, you can think of it either way, but represents the DEMG model with contour length, with convective constraint release added, but no contour length fluctuations. I'm just trying to show you what the various bits of this do. So without contour length fluctuations, you get the same result as with the DEMG model for low strain rate. But then because you're adding this convective mechanism for relaxation, as that comes into play, it shifts the predicted extension of viscosity to lower values at any given strain rate. and shifts this curve downward relative to the Bayer model calculation.
Is that more about diffusive constraint release or just?
No, no diffusive constraint release. There's no diffusive constraint release in any of these calculations. I'll come back to that in a second, in a bit, but if you put these all together, and that's done in these calculations by looking at the MLD model, the Mead-Larsen-Doy model, the original one, the 1998 one, not the dual constraint sort of thing, that, you know, these two things in some sense cancel out. Basically, it produces the pink curve, which is just about as good as matching the data as the blue curve was originally, by the way. So the message, I guess, is that to get this part right down here, you need to add, and to get sure right, you need to add lots of subtle relaxation mechanisms. But in terms of just predicting chain stretching effects primarily, then those are really dominated by this chain by convective constraint release and the chain stretching part of the model, and really. What you gain in terms of understanding this particular data set by going from a simple model essentially to a more complex one is not too much of a change. Especially, I mean, this is representative data, so the data is not it's not like linear viscoelastic data, which is on a absolutely perfect curve. There's some scatter in the data too.
Do you have fine extensibility
here? Do I have what?
Finite extensibility.
Yes, finite extensibility is in, and there's, yes, I didn't show you the equations, but.
Is it crucial which parameter they use for a maximum extension?
Well, the parameter that comes into it is essentially is a molecular weight between entanglements, whatever. And we use just a inverse Langevin.
Yeah, but if you change
function.
It a little bit, factor of two, let's say, nothing happens?
Not much. I mean, it'll obviously, if you start changing that, it'll change where these curves start to turn over at the top. But the data.
Not at the bottom.
But not at the bottom, no.
So you're saying that in those plots, the visible place where the thing turns over, if you, for example, made them not finitely extensible, then they would just go shooting up past it.
That's what I think. That's what I think. Exactly. That's right. That's precisely right.
So does it mean you can fit it without finite extensibility
at all? Basically. I mean, these curves would just go shooting straight up if you didn't put finite extensibility in. And, you know, you could argue that this data starts to bend over a little bit, maybe, but maybe not, too.
It's relying pretty heavily on the left.
Yeah.
Where they turn up is sensitive to tau R estimate, yes?
Of course.
Yeah. And you've got rather large differences in tau R estimate between what the green line, the blue line, and the pink line.
These are a log plot down here, so those are fairly significant differences in where these things should start up.
Yeah, but I'm just thinking, if I look at the green line, for example, and say we naively take now the longest relaxation time as a parameter to fit this curve, And we match
well,
z to zero, the green line doesn't do too badly either.
Well, if I decide to, if I want to let z be a parameter and change the relative spread between timescales, I can obviously shift this point around, but then I don't think that's, I didn't view that as fair.
I'm not doing that, I'm doing something
if that's
different.
What you, oh.
I'm saying we're just going to change the longest relaxation time, which is at, and shift horizontally, and then we match up a to zero, then,
These curves are all, well, there's some difference in the depth of the well and so forth, but they're all qualitatively similar. So if you start shifting them around in some way, you can probably, especially these three curves, if you just start making artificial shifts around, you can probably make them all look sort of like the data, but then I don't see the point of that.
Can I just ask one more question on the finite extensibility, because I really want to get a clear idea of where it becomes important. If you turn it off completely, if you have no finite extensibility for any one of those models, which is the first point of epsilon at which you get an infinite answer for the extension viscosity? Is it around the minimum, or is it around?
No, not the minimum. It's so if you turn off the finite extensibility in the model. Basically, you'll just go shooting up this curve, except you will never turn over. That's all. At first, the linear spring works. Yeah, well, this, exactly. So this thing, well, so I don't know. I don't know. Offhand, I don't know, but.
Is it exactly Rouse time, 5 Rouse time?
I don't know, actually.
I think if I had to guess, it's going to be, if you look at the blue and the red, for example, it's going to be somewhere around epsilon dot equal 1.
Yeah, I mean, it's.
Where you start to get significant.
About here. Except this curve is going to switch. I mean, obviously the slope is going to be a little. As you go up this curve, the slope is going to increase a little, and eventually you're going to just go vertical.
I think it's somewhere around.
Our model breaks around the mean.
That's the problem.
Well, it starts to require finite extensibility around the minimum.
Well, it depends on the separation of Rouse
time. Yeah. Okay, well, anyway, let me show you some more results, and then we can talk about this, because I don't want to take everybody else's time up here. So here's, I want to show one other. So this is the same solution, same data. The only thing that's done here is to change the CLF model from Doi-Kuzu to Milner-McLeish, and actually I should have put another curve on here, except it would be right under this one. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference. So I'm just saying that in itself doesn't really have any impact on this thing. The other thing that's been done here is to include the more ad hoc, or at least what I would view as the more ad hoc version of convective constraint release due to Pino and his collaborators. The difference, well, with some variability in this so-called beta parameter, probably the one you'd like to believe is beta equals 1 if you were going to just think about it from sort of first principles. But the point here is that model doesn't include any impact of convective constraint release on the chain stretching part of the prediction, and therefore, shifts the prediction to the left relative to the other curves, otherwise being sort of more or less indistinguishable depending on what values you put in for beta and so forth and so on. We've done a lot of comparison of different models, especially in the transient shear flow, so I'm going to not. Let me just show you a couple other sets of data just for fun. Here's the case of a very dilute system where Z was about 6. So there's not much data. There's a few things to notice about it. One is that there's a lot more chain stretching. Not surprising. The molecular weight between entanglements is a lot higher, so you'd expect that. Also, the data, although it's scattered around, is more or less consistent with a sort of just monotonic increase in the extensional viscosity from without any preliminary strain rate thinning. And once you add, so this is, again, the MLD model. This is the DEMG model with contour length fluctuations. Once you add that to the model, then it also, for these parameters, it predicts essentially a monotonic increase in the extensional viscosity. So that's kind of vaguely interesting. M and C. The previous one was 6%, 6 weight percent. Molecular weight was 10.2 million. The more polydispersed one. Here's the.
So why would I see more stretching in the shorter?
With the smaller number of entanglements per chain, just because the molecular weight between entanglements is higher. And. Well, yeah. Oh, sorry. Okay. So the I should compare the same molecular weight to make the statement, if you'd like. So, for example, here's the equivalent case to what here's. So this is the 4 million molecular weight solution at 10 weight percent with the same number of entanglements per chain, essentially, as that 10.2 million one I showed before. So now I can say what I said before. If you compare this one to the less entangled one, then you see a lot less chain stretching, and both predicted and measured, than you do when you have a smaller number of entanglements per chain. Yeah, your point is well taken. So I've left out a lot of the curves here. So this is DEMG, the Mead-Larsen-Doi theory, the DEMG with contour length fluctuations. So it looks basic. So I'm not going to show you more of that because it all looks pretty much. They all look about the same. We haven't quite finished this, but here's some. We also have transient data. both startup data and relaxation data. So here's a couple randomly chosen, and there's some change in notation. It was supposed to be Z, but anyway, some randomly chosen points to just illustrate the kind of transient data that TAM has and the degree to which the model reproduces it. And it's the same three models, DEMG, Mead-Larson-Doi, DEMG with contour length fluctuation data. This is actually at a fairly low strain rate, and at the lowest strain rates, their experiment is struggling to get to steady state, obviously. You could, whether this is steady state or not, you could argue. As you increase the strain rate, well, actually, whatever. Well, that's it was one of the lowest strain rate points in the previous thing I was showing you, so it doesn't really, if whether that's true steady state or it should be somewhat higher, wouldn't make much difference really in the steady state prediction. Here's a higher strain rate set of data, and this one I think does arguably reach a reasonable asymptote. It's hard to get to it. You have to have big strain to get to a steady state. So here's the DEMG. Here's Mead-Larson-Doi. This happened to be a point where the two were different. If you went back and looked at those previous slides, you know, the two curves sort of parallel each other, but they cross at some point and so forth. So depending on what point you pick, you can make this part of it look different. I think the main message here is that the time scale is roughly right, that there's something missing at short or intermediate times, and presumably that's at least partly diffusive constraint release. And that's about it.
Just the linear viscoelastic spectra isn't very well represented by the linear limits of those models, right? So you might expect the early time step to not be very accurate.
Well, that's, yeah.
I think there's a bit more to it than that, because when we run our model, the same kind of, you basically get very, very similar results, and the steady state is fine. The shape of the curvature for these experimental data is opposite to what the model predicts.
You can get
this shape. I just want to conclude by showing a little bit of data on the other kinds of non-shear flow that where we have data. So we've done some real optical experiments in our laboratory on these mixed type flows, and I'm just drawing. So these are flows that are parameterized. They're planar flows. They're parameterized by a so-called flow type parameter alpha. The way we do things, when alpha is equal to 1, it's a purely extensional flow, and the principal strain rate axis essentially is what I've called AA prime. If you had a purely extensional flow, you would expect material points to separate along that line exponentially with a rate that's proportional to the strain rate times time, or e to the strain rate times time. If you look at an intermediate flow, that is, so in a way you can think of this as taking this flow and adding vorticity to it, adding rotation to it. At intermediate values of this flow type parameter, between 0, which is simple shear flow, and 1, which is pure extension, you get these so-called mixed type flows, which look a lot like these flows, except that these two axes start coming together. In the limit, as alpha goes to 0, these two, the AA prime axis and this one basically scissor together and become coincident with the X curve. That's simple shear flow, right? So that's how this works. If you have something aligned along this asymptotic long time alignment axis, the CC prime axis, then it still goes exponentially. It just goes exponentially with a slightly reduced effective stretching rate, if you like, which depends upon the strain rate times the square root of the so-called flow type parameter. This is just the principal eigenvalue of the velocity gradient tensor, basically, in this. Okay, So as I said before, some kind of fundamental transition occurs if you go all the way to alpha equals 0. Any small but non-zero value of alpha here goes exponentially. Alpha equals 0 goes algebraically. So as long as you have alpha positive, you might expect that this case would be somewhat more difficult to model than a purely extensional flow, in the sense that you have to get both the degree of stretch and the orientation right, whereas in the purely extensional uniaxial flow, orientation direction is not an issue, basically. So we had some data that we took quite some time ago that we went back and took a look at model comparisons, the same model. Unfortunately, I didn't have a, these are just copies out of a paper, but so they don't look as nice, but anyway. So what's shown here is birefringence data for steady flow for a particular flow type, which actually has what should be said alpha equal 0.02. So this is a flow which is pretty close to shear flow. It's not shear flow, but it's, you know, it's a flow that's almost down to simple shear flow. What's plotted, the data that's plotted is orientation angle, and the nomenclature here is that if that's zero, that's alignment with the x-axis, which is where it would go, is the flow direction in simple shear flow. 45 degrees is the principal strain rate axis. So base, and what's plotted here is strain rate, essentially. Or so as the strain rate increases, the measurable orientation axis and birefringence orients away from the principal strain rate direction toward some asymptotic alignment direction. The key point is that that asymptotic alignment direction is not zero. The angle is not zero. It's also not what you would calculate particularly for this flow type parameter, however, because this is a viscoelastic flow, and so actually the flow chain is changing simultaneously. So anyway, so that's the data. Here's the birefringence data. There's three curves on here. They're not, so there's two curves which are basically DEMG model calculations. The solid curve and the long dash curve, the difference being old values of parameters that we estimated a number of years ago, better estimates of parameters, we think, at the moment, but still just the EMG model. And the small dashed line is the MLD model, okay? With the parameters determined from linear viscoelastic data that we had from this study in the exact same way I showed you before.
Here again, left, in a correct calculation, all curves should merge in the linear data, which they don't.
Yeah, I'll have to look at that. I don't know why they don't, actually, when I stop and think about it. I didn't really think about it, because we were mostly focused on higher strain rate information. But yeah, I think you're right.
The solid black line, you thought it was used also with different strain.
Well, the solid black line, no. That's done with, that's got different parameter estimate in it. Let's see. Yeah. Well, anyway. Well, let me mention. Okay, so let me tell you how. So here's the data, but let me tell you how the plot was produced. Because how do I get the strain rate first of all? Because I don't know the strain rate, right? It changed, and it's not what you would think. This is a two-row mill, so you turn on the cylinders, and if you had a Newtonian viscous fluid, there would be some particular strain rate. This data, by the way, is taken at the stagnation point. I forgot to mention that. In the region between the two cylinders. And the strain rates that appear here are measured ones. And so when the model calculations were done, they include measured values of the flow parameters as input and the predicted birefringence, essentially, and orientation angle as output, right? So they include measured. So it's not a full flow calculation, in other words. We measure the flow data, put it into the model to make predictions of birefringence and orientation angle.
So right. You get not just the strain rate, but also an equivalent alpha?
Exactly. You have to get both alpha. Yeah. I'm just not showing you that data, but yes, we have that data. We got that originally by a light scattering technique that I can tell you about, but dynamic light scattering technique. Anyway, there's a fairly amazing degree of correspondence, I would say, between model predictions and data in this intermediate flow. The orientation angle, this would be expected from what I showed you before, but the orientation angle part is new information, if you like, a little bit. And, well, if you look at other flow types, this picture is not perfect, but it's still similar. One peculiar thing about it is we tend to find that at high strain rates, the measured and predicted angles tend to deviate somewhat, but it's not really reflected in any noticeable way, at least over the strain rate range that we've looked at in the comparison between the birefringence and the birefringence data. Presumably there's canceling errors or canceling effects of some sort or other. The angle always, the model, even with convective constraint release and so forth built into it, always predicts an over-rotation, if you like, away from the principal strain axis relative to what we see in the data. The reason these are bumpy, by the way, is because these are based on instead of being curves, these are really discrete points with lines drawn between them, and the discrete points have measured flow data in them, which is not exactly perfect. So there's.
So the models include staging.
Yes. Yes.
And I would say that all models I know which include staging predict at the end of the day, they predict zero orientation. When you start to stage significantly, the orientation angle.
No, no.
It goes to the plot, no. And then it starts to go yes. down again?
Not, no, no.
The principal direction.
Yeah, exactly. And the principal direction here is not zero.
Ah.
That's the whole point about these strong flows, not shear flows.
What is that angle?
Well, I mean, you can calculate from the flow type parameter, you can calculate what this asymptotic angle would be in a Newtonian fluid, and it's usually above what the data and what the model predicts, just because when the flow starts changing, two things happen. The velocity gradient magnitude goes down. The flows tend to shift toward shear flow. They tend to,
inhibit extension.
Right, if you want to think of it that way. They tend to change themselves in such a way as to inhibit extension at some level. And they can do that both by reducing, you know, within the constraints of the system, they can do that by reducing the strain rate and by changing the flow type. And they do both, actually. All right. Well, I think I'll just about stop here. There's more data of that kind too. So what my little messages are the following: not all flows are alike. Classification schemes are significant. Strong flows are dominated by chain stretch and CCR. And as far as getting that part of model predictions for strong flows right, the other mechanisms in the model are not so important. Our view was that to get the low strain rate part right, we need to add diffusive constraint release to the model. But you have to keep in mind that that's going to change the estimate of the reptation and therefore the Rouse time. And if you don't do anything else, would shift the predictions to the left of the data, basically. So our view of that is, well, you better simultaneously take into account the dual constraint release, or whatever you want to call it, and the convective constraint release part of the model too, which will shift it back the other way and probably more or less cancel out, hopefully.
But by double rotation in CCI, you mean you want to change beta parameter?
No, I'm talking, so for example, I'm talking in about the generalization of something like the generalization of the Mead-Larson-Adoy model to the famous, as yet unpublished paper that includes dual constraint release ideas, basically, for example. I mean, I'm not sure what the proper, I'm not suggesting that we have a detailed way ourselves of thinking about how to do this apart from what's already been suggested in the literature. But. And I didn't really say enough about this to say, Jim will say something that will go along with this, but one of the things we are, this should actually be CLF too, by the way. If you put in different convective, if different contour length fluctuation models, or you put in different CCR models, then you take a look at what the models predict in terms of details about the distribution of orientations along the chain, they're actually quite different. But when you calculate rheological or rheo-optical information, you hardly see the difference, which even in transient flows, which seems pretty surprising.
Well, because contour-length changes are not important in very fast.
No, but the point is that suppose you put in a different distribution of orientations along the chain, and then you subject the chain to something like a an abrupt change in strain rate or something like that. You'd expect in detail the way the chain responds to the flow to depend on what the distribution of orientations is along the chain. And the fact that they're minor. The fact they're quite, it's not so well.
Well, it's difficult to catch.
Well, the place you probably see is when it's like cessation of steady flow. The orientation angle, the extension angle changes in time, and the shape of that's probably very sensitive.
Well, we've been looking. All I can say is we've looked hard for. We've looked hard for signature for cases where there is clear signatures of. So if you make model calculations, you say, you know, these models produce quite, depending on how you do CCR in particular, they produce quite different distributions of orientation along the chain. And yet, when you try to make calculations in transient or steady flows of various kinds, it's not reflected in anything that we can measure easily with our experiments. That's all I guess I can say. Which I didn't, which I did, well, no, but transient too. I'm saying transients too.
But maybe a cessation of flow.
Yeah. So, Jim, I guess you're.
Well, Jim says, let's give thank you, Erica. That's not my technical.
Oh, wait a minute.
This is very easy.
Here's this.
Now would be a good time for
you. You need this.
Right. Okay.
I was going to say this. There's a gentle trick of the bathroom breaks in and you know the time to last all day. Good. All right. I'd like to get myself as far away from the middle as I can, but I'm not standing in front of everyone.
Well, I'd like to concentrate.
Richard will just. Do I need to do the reboot thing?
Yeah,
oh, the
F7 or whatever it is. It depends on mine, but it sure will depend on that.
But it'll still be warming.
It is F8.
It will happen. It's never let us down yet.
Hallelujah.
You can tell the switch in generations, right? I use new grass.
It's what you do when you're making transparencies 5 minutes to 10. So printing becomes a little bit of a challenge. Really? It's a good thing I'm not trying, man. I'll be faster. What's that?
It's
flickering? Maybe it's because it's warming up.
No, it'll do that the whole time.
Really? Okay, you guys are going to end up with a headache at the end of this thing. Well, my guy running the session is kind of not here, so I thought it might be nice if we waited for him.
We're having a separate meeting in the coffee room.
Well, I'm not going to be nearly as long as you anyway, so.
Gary, aren't you worried about steady state?
Right. What do you mean I'm not worried about steady state?
Doesn't look to me like any of the data are in steady state. It could be ordered from there to not.
The extensional data?
Yeah. You've got to plot things against log time and have them be flat.
Yeah, but don't you have these four transients in one plot? Try to fit them. Because then, even if you don't get true steady state, you'll see the tendency.
Okay. We ready?
Steady state in an engagement
flow. Yeah, it might not be, but you can see the shape.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, at the risk of sounding like. At the risk of sounding like Paul Harvey of radio fame, I'll now give you the rest of the story here. We're going to talk mostly about steady and transient shear flows and try to make some of the similar types of comparisons that Gary was talking about, although I have to say with all the continued revisionist history about how you use timescales properly in these things, the extension stuff has been a little bit ahead of me, and so a lot of these things I haven't had a great deal of time to look at myself, and some of the transient data is
a little bit more limited than I would otherwise like. As Tom mentioned earlier, this is sort of a home and home talk here back to back, except for the fact that I got traded to a different team about a year ago. And so it's nice to be back, actually. So we're going to talk about, and I can jump into this because Gary's giving you all the preamble about the methodology of what we're doing here. But in this case here, we're going to talk about two different material systems altogether. So these are going to be two different 8 million molecular weight systems, polystyrene and tricresyl phosphate solvent. And we choose that one because it's non-volatile and the shear apparatus is open to the air, so we need to minimize evaporation effects. Yes, I did indeed forget to change that to Z. So anytime you see NE running around, that's the number of entanglements per chain. My apologies. Old habits die hard. So the two different solutions, the same molecular weight, different concentrations, such that the number of entanglements per chain are approximately twice as large or small relative to one another. And I've quoted this plateau modulus in the same fashion that we've calculated these things for the previous systems. And then as well, I don't know why it's doing that, the time scales in an exactly analogous fashion. And so as Gary said, if we calculate these things from fits to linear viscoelastic data using the Milner-McLeish type of methodology, you get time scales that are larger than if you were to have compensated for contour length fluctuations by kind of lumping it into a time scale. And so just simply want to keep in mind, the one thing that is going to be convenient, I'm going to ultimately be plotting all of these things in the transients, and, well, actually in the steady states, against strain rate. And as Gary may or may not have mentioned, I don't recall at this point, when you're playing games with using two different sets of time scales, it's difficult to use a Weisenberg number because it's relative to what becomes the question. But at least in the case here, it's convenient that these times are more or less the same and close to one, so you can calculate a Weisenberg number in your head relatively easily. And these are at least more or less the same as well. And simpletons like me like these sorts of things. Okay, so we're going to be talking about couette flow, so it's going to be more or less simple shear. And it's all going to be rheo-optical data. So we're going to be...
I'm sorry, Jim, could you back up just a little
point? If I can figure out how to do that. Oops, wrong way.
How did it happen that changing the concentration so much and doubling it didn't do anything to the RALS flow?
I trust Alexei's answer to that more,
yeah,
because...
I got the same answer.
Yeah, because you did some similar fits for us as well, and we got sort of similar behavior.
You get conciliation of two effects. You get more viscous, but you get less than that. And
what the question was?
The question is a little odd that changing the concentration so much.
Why are they the same?
The number of entanglements by factor two left you with basically the same Rouse time.
Rouse time doesn't depend on the impact.
The
Clearly, time scales are still an issue, is the message to all of this, I suppose. They're certainly an issue to me. So we're going to talk about rheo optics, and so we're going to be presenting data for orientation angle or extinction angle and birefringence. We're going to look at a variety of systems. We're going to start with steady shear, move to startup of shear, and then these sort of more interesting transients in terms of the subtleties of the response, which I call double-step shear rate. And in that particular problem, we're going to allow the system to come to a steady state at some particular shear rate and then very rapidly increase or decrease the shear rate but maintain the flow direction. And then in the subsequent one here, we're just changing the flow direction but the same methodology. Okay, so this is just experimental data for these two systems, and what I'm plotting is the extinction angle against the shear rate, and the long and the short of it is that at low shear rates, you're seeing orientation effects taking hold a little bit earlier with the more entangled system, as one might have expected, since the disengagement time is larger for that material. But at high shear rates, where the tau r's are approximately the same, you're seeing saturation of orientation effects, and so these things are starting to fall onto one another.
So B means more?
Oh, yes. Yeah, B is the 4.8%. So that's the 25 entanglements per chain system, and this is the 12.8 or so. And then for the birefringence, one of the most notable things perhaps is the absence of any serious plateau. The birefringence increases more or less monotonically for both systems. I should point out that I've scaled this with respect to the plateau modulus and a stress optical coefficient, so this is a dimensionless birefringence. And again, similar sorts of effects. You see some differences at low shear rates, but at high shear rates, they start to fall on top of one another. Okay, so the next thing I want to show is orientation angle versus shear rate for one of these systems, and I'm going to start with model comparisons now. So we're going back to the slightly less entangled system. I'm going to show the same three types of model comparisons that Gary was talking about as well. So the first one, once I get the data up here, so this is the data we were looking at a moment ago, and now I'm going to add the black curve, which is with these time scales that supposedly take into account contour-like fluctuations sort of lumped into their value. And you see you do a reasonably good job at low shear rates, as you might have expected, because you're effectively compensating for the contour-length fluctuation effects. But as you increase the shear rate, you see much, much more rotation towards the flow direction than you would otherwise like, and that's in principle caused because we're not including CCR at this point. So you might expect this type of behavior. If you go and add the same model, but go back to the real time scales and take into account in a physical way with contour length fluctuations, you see basically all you've done is shifted things a little bit upwards. Okay, and so the benefit of the contour length fluctuations actually has some benefit down here in the sense that you're causing portions of the chain to rotate away from the flow direction and expose them a little bit more to the velocity gradient. And then subsequently, if you go to the Mead-Larson-Doy model, you see very similar behavior with the contour length fluctuation model a moment ago at low strain rates or shear rates. But as you increase the shear rate, you start to see that CCR has a profound effect and does a much more reasonable job of hitting the high shear rate regime, although there is a tendency still for this to become still over-oriented, I think, with the flow direction as you continue to increase the shear rate. It becomes still a bit of a problem, as I think we'll see in a moment.
But again, you lose the low shear rate?
At this point, yes. Yes. Okay, so same thing for the next solution. So there's our data, and there's again this basic model. This one, ironically, doesn't look nearly as good as the previous, and you'd think that as you get more and more entangled, you do a more and more effective job of this. One of the things about all of these fits, I should add the caveat, I didn't show you any of the linear viscoelastic data. Some of the fits that we have are not exactly my favorites in many respects. I would have wished for more. These are, yeah, the molecular weight distribution for both of these systems is about 1.17, which is the same as the 10 million molecular weight stuff that Gary was talking about. So there are some issues there, perhaps with timescales, that are causing some problems. So we add the green curve, very similar qualitative behavior to what you saw before. And if you add CCR, again, you start doing a slightly better job out here. And would that we had more data points to actually see whether this trend holds true. It's very difficult to infer much of anything from this.
When you make three lines like that, you're holding what constant? Are you taking each model and independently doing an independent fit to the linear viscoelastic spectra, or are you keeping all the bare parameters constant? Just
essentially the first.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
So it serves to, at these lowest rates, wouldn't you have expected, if they're all equally good fits for linear viscoelasticity, you might have thought that I would have been.
Well, and out here, that's true. Out in here, there are some subtleties, okay? Because, right, that obviously they're going to get right. The problem is in here, there are going to be some differences between the black curve and the other two curves. And the reason is that in the black curve, we're giving some sort of lump sum value that accounts for contour length fluctuations, but it's applying it to the whole chain. Whereas these other models are applying the contour length fluctuation effect more appropriately towards the ends of the chain predominantly. So you see different segmental orientations, which I think I'm going to show in a minute, if I remember correctly.
But the theories are very close to one another.
Yes.
The theory, by the way.
Yes.
So it's
And the irony to all of this is previous iteration of time scale, previous iteration of time scales, we weren't here, but we were over here. And so you can see that we're a little bit confused, and we have been for some time, about what is the appropriate time scale to use in all this. Yeah?
So the plane is time scales that shift over here?
If you change the time scales, it does shift things basically left to right.
Except the one difference is stretching is not right, it's not quite shifted the same way. How sensitive are these curves to the estimates for tau n?
In the sense that if I change... That's my question. Unless I change number of entanglements per chain or something to that effect. Yeah, then you'd see a broadening of some of this. You might see... how do I say this? You might see an elevation of... a reduction, actually. If you increase tau Rouse, this has been a... Well, actually, I take that back. If you change tau Rouse, increase it, for instance... you get, to some extent, such a high degree of orientation in shear that it doesn't have an enormous effect. It's going to have much more of a profound effect in the more extensional type flows.
So you're saying it's not sensitive here?
Not especially. And I have done some different calculations. I just can't remember off the top of my head exactly what the shift is.
It's hard to blame polydispersing.
Right.
No, it's limitation constraints, basically.
Yeah.
Needs more detailed version of complement equations, and both effects smoothest transition from 45 degree.
Exactly.
You always get much smoother transition if you put more detail. If you put distribution of frequencies and rotation constraint phase, you get very smooth.
Now the constants that you generated for us were more along the ones that I talked about we used in our previous iterations, and that had us over here. So if you added your parameters with diffusive constraint release, you might find that you shift yourself back to the point where you're pretty close to your experimental data. That might be what I would expect, frankly.
If you use a convective constraint release, I think that the intermangular at high shear rate is going to some constant
Okay, I'm going to push the button now, okay. Okay, so the same stuff with birefringence. There's the data, and there was that initial DEMG with the basic time scales. And the most important thing is simply the fact that you're plateauing. You're getting such a high degree of orientation with the flow direction that there's nothing for the flow to get a grip on. It can't stretch anything. So it's basically saturating orientation, and there's effectively no stretch. So if you start to include contour length fluctuations and use more realistic time scales, you're rotating parts of the chain away from the flow direction, exposing them to that velocity gradient, and you get a little bit more representative fit. So you're getting a more turn up here. So you're exposing some, inducing some stretch effectively. And then if you go the same route and add convective constraint release, again, you're rotating a little bit further away still now. Okay, so you're again allowing the chain to stretch a little bit more. Okay, so you're going the right direction, in other words, in terms of trying to reduce the orientation effects, which in turn improve your predictions with birefringence.
Can I make earlier the point about the slow at high rates?
Right.
Can you fit it with some polynomial, or you're not?
It's difficult in the sense that I'm not confident enough that we're that's the problem. I'm not comfortable with the fact that there's not really enough data to draw too many conclusions. In this particular apparatus, you get some issues with effectively rod climbing through a thin gap and starts coming over the top and causes all sorts of technical difficulties. It's a bad thing. The error bars actually for birefringence are pretty tight. I realize I don't have them on this particular plot, but they're only slightly larger than the dots themselves. So
for birefringence,
orientation angle, there's much less, there's much more error associated with that.
So this agreement at the beginning is significant.
Yeah. I mean, I trust these values reasonably well. So real quick, same solution, or different solution rather, same setup. We've seen that effect before. We're saturating orientation. Add contour length fluctuations, it's getting in the right direction, but not entirely there. And then you add CCR, and again, it's, in this case, you're obviously doing a little bit better. I don't really know what to garner from this, except for the fact that you're getting more entangled, so you're starting to generate a plateau that's not reflected in the data. And so you need something that's going to induce a little bit additional relaxation in this sort of intermediate shear rate regime that's clearly not reflected in any sort of model prediction here. Okay, and then just a quick point about the shear stress. That's the shear stress for the data, and this is the well-known shear stress maximum that you get with the basic DEMG model. Dropping off like a madman here. If you add contour length fluctuations, you temper it a little bit, and then if you add the CCR model, you temper it a little bit further, but you're still getting a maximum, and you really don't want to rely upon contour length fluctuations to eliminate this effect, since if you go to the limit of an infinitely entangled system, CCR isn't going to help you enough. You're still going to get a shear stress maximum. So this is where things like diffusive constraint release are clearly an essential element to trying to eliminate this sort of spurious feature. Okay, so what I want to do real quick here is zoom in on...
That last statement you made, CCR by itself is not enough to get rid of the shear stress maximum. That is a statement that's true of some people's implementation of CCR, but not all.
It's certainly true of the MLD model version of it. Obviously, Giovanni et al. Have played games with the beta parameter, at least with the Doy Edwards version of the model.
We add the CCR too.
Okay, well, diffusive constraint release, though.
Well, it's kind of like,
we didn't play with beta. We played with beta.
Your previous paper, you played with beta, though, and found a point at which, well, it's very old, but.
I think Scott's referring to a paper on which he's.
Which one was this? Got to refresh my memory.
The microscopic.
Right.
CCR. In that paper, Alexa and I showed that.
Right, I do remember this.
Version seems to get rid of the maximum.
And that was the one that didn't have chain stretching in it.
Didn't have chain stretching in it, which for your purpose makes it useless. But the promise is, though, that you wouldn't actually.
Fair enough. What I want to do real quick is blow up a couple of these points and basically show that there's some distinctions in the segmental orientation angle for all of these cases. Now, in this zone, obviously the three model predictions are fairly close in terms of the orientation angle prediction, yet the differences between them are quite different in some respects. The basic DEMG model gives you more or less a constant orientation across the chain with this sharp spike because of the free end that it has to go to 45 degrees.
Is this the gamma dot on the x-axis?
No, this is the product of being up at very late hours last night. That should be a tube coordinate, my apologies, where this is basically the center of the chain and this is the end of the chain. Yes, the gamma dot is a 0.05 in this case. My mistake.
Center
is at zero. And the end is at 0.5. So this is your free end, basically, which has to go to an isotropic configuration. And so, like I said, more or less a constant orientation. Adding contour length fluctuation effects broadens this effectively. And that becomes particularly significant when you're trying to do complex transients, like we're going to talk about in a moment. And then for equal time, if you go to a higher shear rate, and again, this is obviously the tube coordinate, you see that CCR also plays a role in distinguishing the green curve from the red curve in terms of the segmental orientation angle. So all of these things play a role if you're concerned with trying to get transient predictions right.
Go back for just a minute while I take a quick little artist sketch.
Whoop. Maybe I'll fix it and make it S instead of gamma dot.
Yeah, we get quicker.
Okay. So what I want to do now is move towards startup. And the only thing that I really want to point out is that we're ramping from a variety of shear rates, obviously. But the most salient feature that one is sort of interested in trying to capture these extinction angle undershoots. As you go to increasingly higher strain rate, or shear rates rather, this becomes a feature that starts to crop up. And I think it starts showing up in either the green or the blue. And you'll notice that these correspond to about 0.1 or 0.2 shear rate. And knowing that the Rouse time is the order of one, that seems low. And the reason I say that is because these have typically been ascribed to a chain stretching type effect. In other words, as you start up flow, you stretch molecules, they start to orient, and as they orient with the flow direction, the impetus to have induced that stretch is removed as it orients, so it tends to relax, and the orientation angle is increasing then at some higher strain. The only reason I plotted these on strain is to basically get them on the same plot. I should point that out. So these are at what appear to be lower Weisenberg numbers for chain stretching to be a relevant issue, although I would add the caveat, of course, that these are values that are lumping a diffusive constraint release type of mechanism into the value of the timescale. And so if you use timescales like Alexei's that are more representative of that type of mechanism, you might see an effective Weisenberg number that's closer to order one than these would seem to suggest. But the point, yes?
Sorry, you mentioned before that there were larger errors in the orientation angle, but how would you say that the errors compared to the size of the undershoot?
Many more errors here at the low strains. As you get to higher shear rates, the errors are very, very minimal. Much less than the magnitude of the undershoot.
Shouldn't we just naively say that the error bar is one of the big wiggles on those curves?
Yeah. I mean that would be reasonable. Absolutely.
So will you say that the extinction angle is much better quantity measured experimentally?
I'm sure there's not an undershoot on the first curve.
In the sense that if you're looking simply at mechanical measurements, I don't think you're going to see artifacts that give you this sort of character. It just doesn't show up.
Regions and stress are dependent on the same moments of the distribution, but in different combinations. So, and you measure things with different sensitivities. So you actually, in principle, if you can measure everything exactly, then you get equivalent information. But since you can't, you get different insights from doing this than you would.
Yeah,
have
but
would
you say that precision K is better in general?
As far as getting, well, I mean, I don't know if it's better. I mean,
it's done by the data.
Yeah, it's precision.
I should also point out that these are all averages of five runs, and so this is not a single run issue here. Okay. So we've averaged a set of these, and this is what. Just spit out.
Different runs, you can estimate error.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, and that's how I think I had error. I'm not sure if I had error bars at the beginning or not when I showed the steady state data. Mm-hmm. I have too many Excel spreadsheets, yeah. But some of them I have error bars, and you know we can certainly talk about that.
And the other thing is that pointing out is obviously you can do this for different flow types.
Yes.
Which the rheometer.
Right. Certainly. Although if you get into
once you do transient other kinds of flow, you end up, except for Tam's thing, if you do transient other flows,
the flow modification becomes a problem.
The fluid dynamics measurements you have
right. That changes temporally as well, and that becomes.
They do. I mean, but they're just.
It becomes tedious.
You have to measure the flow type carefully, and the velocity gradient is a function of time, too. Right?
Well, the ones that are purely extensional. I mean, there again, you don't know what extension rate you're getting, but can you do some sort of feedback?
The one
that fixed by making.
You mean CAM's measurements?
No, yours.
The DLS, though, and the birefringents are conducted at separate times.
Typically.
They're not done concurrently, so trying to do it a live feedback is currently not an option.
You don't know the velocity.
You don't know
unless you measure it with DLS.
You don't know the strain rate, you have to measure it. As a function of time, if you're going to do a transient.
I'd be happy to. Birefringence, again, the only thing to significantly point out is, again, overshoots, chain stretching. Again, you're starting to see onset of overshoots, about the same shear rates that you're starting to see the undershoots in the orientation angle, which is, again, sort of inferential argument that they may be related to one another.
You don't need stretching to get overshoot here, do you?
I certainly hope you do.
In
birefringence,
it's
you
like
do.
It's
like a normal stress difference, yeah.
What's the longest relaxation time?
It depends on how you want to interpret it. I think it's on the order of 90 seconds. If you, yeah, terminal time. What I'm calling tau DMM is about 90 seconds.
Just the point, G-prime and G-double-prime cross.
Well, I don't know if that correlates exactly. No, that would be smaller than tau DMM. That would be more like tau DDEMG.
The terminal time is, you can tell them what that is. Yeah,
I don't have.
The longest made will relax even then.
Forty-seven seconds, I think.
Order
50, maybe.
When do you start the zero? So that's the vulnerable depth of this time is when you start the zero.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what everybody believes. That's to be expected from
any society. You start to see these presumably when Rouse-based Weisenberg numbers order one.
That's
Rouse time order.
We're talking about if you use your terminal
time. If you look at the Weisenberg number based on terminal time, you're going to get absolute monotonic time dependence, no overshoot whatsoever.
In birefringence. In shear stress, though, but that's different. Birefringence is related more closely to the first normal stress difference.
The first normal stress difference. That's really what this looks very similar to the first normal stress difference.
Okay, so that's a chain stretching issue.
Given that data and the angle data, you can calculate the shear stress. If you calculate the shear stress, you get an overshoot.
Right.
From this data, too.
But at lower shear rates, you get more shear stress component than normal stress component.
Absolutely. And of course, then eventually that changes.
So that the overshoot still could be tied to shear stress overshoot rather than normal stress overshoot at low shear rates.
There is a contribution from the shear stress, yes.
Yeah, the shear stress overshoot is at lower. Doesn't have anything to do with chain stress.
Okay. I don't remember what this is. Oh, these are model predictions. That's right. See, it's late night. The moral of the story is obviously this is an incomplete set of data, first of all. But the only thing I wanted to point out, this is basic DEMG with those basic DEMG timescales. You don't see any undershoots. Okay. And I'll continue on. If you move to the point where you have Mead, Larson, Doy with all the bells and whistles, you still don't see any undershoots. Okay. Now, all I can tell you is sort of qualitatively that we've observed that if you sort of artificially start compressing the separation between the timescales, then you'll start to induce an undershoot in the orientation angle. But how you're going to do that in a proper sense is obviously a subject of open debate, but adding alternative mechanisms would clearly lead you in that right direction. Okay, double step stuff. So this is the one where we start up shear flow, come to steady state, and then instantaneously or virtually so, increase or decrease the shear rate. And what we're showing here is the extinction angle, orientation angle, as a function of strain. And if you take blue, green, purple, and red, and light blue, these are all with the same all of these are with the same final shear rate. These four are all step increases. And what you see initially is you see the orientation angle ostensibly goes in what you would perceive to be the wrong direction.
These two are taken in the same direction, but with different
speed. Correct. So for these four, where it's a step increase experiment, you see that the orientation angle becomes what you would perceive to be a less oriented state before it rotates around and comes to its ultimate steady state orientation angle. And similarly, if you do the step decrease experiment, you see an undershoot, which would lead you to say, hey, I'm decreasing the shear rate, I'm becoming more oriented. So completely belies any intuition, except if you start making mental arguments, at least, about how chain stretching might be playing a role. And if you have some steady state stretch, for instance, in these particular systems, prior to the change in shear rate, you might see that if you decrease the shear rate, you're going to relax some of that. And so you're going to be a retraction into more oriented tube segments, and consequently, an undershoot in the orientation angle. Then as time goes on, reptation and other processes occur such that it's moving towards its ultimate steady state configuration, so it recovers. You can make the converse argument for the step increase type of experiments, where if you increase the shear rate, you're inducing a transient stretch of sorts. And then you start rotating towards the flow direction, you relax that stretch.
And you preferentially stretch parts of the chain that are oriented more in the...
You're stealing my thunder here, my friend.
I thought you were going to go to the next slide.
Well, I am, but that's where we're going here. just real quick, birefringence, to point out that all the dynamic in the orientation angle was occurring basically from here to the left, and you don't see anything here that would be suggestive of the same subtle nuance that you see with the orientation angle. One other point to make, you see these things down to very, very low shear rates. Okay, so it really starts to disappear with this blue curve, which is from a shear rate of 0.005 to 0.01. And basically, you're getting to the point where it's just noise. And so I don't think you're losing it for any particular physical meaning other than the fact that you can't discriminate it against the background because it's a low signal. Okay, so this is, again, seems to belie a lot of what one would intuitively think is going on in terms of chain stretching mechanisms, because these would, to all appearances, seem to be far too low to induce anything meaningful in a stretch. So what I wanted to point out is the following. You might expect that this would be an extremely difficult challenge for a model. Yet if you go back to a basic Doy-Edwards model without a chain stretching effect, which is what this is, and granted I'm using wrong time scales and everything, but the same qualitative arguments can be made, you actually see a little bit of it. And all of this is kind of rolled up into the dynamic of the Q tensor. Okay, so how you choose your strain measure is obviously an important issue. So this is strain measure induced orientation angle over and undershoots. Okay, so as you go towards more complex models, this gives you hope, first of all, that you might be able to represent the data more effectively, because at least you have a starting point. And so what you might hope to do is to augment this type of effect. One other point is, where is this transient effect being located? And the point is, you see, most of the overshoot is out here near the end of the chain, as you might expect. Yeah, epsilon the bottom. No, that's strain. Don't mess with me. This is strain. Actually, got it right this time. But you see, the most of the overshoot, again, is at the end of the chain. And as you move towards the center, you're not seeing any sort of the effect.
The curves correspond to orientation of different parts of the chain.
Right. Well, chain center. You're moving towards the chain center. This was 10 minutes before 10 when I was making this one. So
great.
Did the best I could, you know?
Black is out toward the end of the chain.
And so this is what one might have expected. Okay, you're seeing the less oriented chains preferentially experiencing this type of an effect. So it's all qualitative at this point, but still useful. Unfortunately, the end result is not quite as palatable as one might hope. If you take the model with all the bells and whistles, you haven't done a whole lot to really make this look very pretty. And so, quite frankly, I don't have any particularly interesting answers to this.
Sorry, what's wrong with this?
Well, the data is a much more profound effect still.
The magnitude is way different, for example. The time scales are off. Nothing about it. It's qualitatively right, but nothing else is right.
Right. You're not getting, for instance, the time at which this rolls over anywhere near the same. Yeah. You're not getting the magnitude of the overshoot nearly as accurate as you might hope. And to some extent, this is going to be reflective of your starting point. You know, if you're not getting the steady state data exactly right, that's going to have an effect on whether you're going to get the transient right, certainly. But then this is also where the chain configuration plays a role, because clearly the chain configuration, if you have more less oriented segments, let's say, a broader distribution of orientations along the chain, you might augment this type of effect a little bit more. So sort of food for thought, I suppose. Okay. One last thing. I'm not going to show any model predictions for this, but this is the so-called reversing step strain rate. And again, this is all sort of in the theme of how can you challenge models and give them something against which to compare. And the last one is a very subtle effect, where you're really probing segmental dynamics and trying to get those things more accurate. This is back towards the idea of startup, in the sense that you're requiring a complete chain redistribution of orientation. Okay. So, quite frankly, if you get into the model predictions, I expected you're going to have a little bit more success with this than one might with the subtle response of the double steps. But basically what you see is, and now I've had to go into the negative axis because we're reversing the flow directions, but basically the orientation angle moves into the other quadrants, so it's moving from a compression to an extension sort of domain, I suppose. And you get different magnitudes of these overshoots. And the pink curve, which is the lowest initial strain rate, or shear rate, keep doing that, I've been talking about extension too much lately, basically is starting as close to an isotropic configuration as any of these data. And subsequently, when it flips, it's also coming very close to the isotropic domain as well. And so all of these are consistent with... Yeah, and as if you were actually to overlay the startup comes down in here and overlays very nicely, basically. And then simply birefringence, again, if you're trying to test models, you might try to get these qualitative features in terms of the width of these undershoots, the magnitude of the undershoots, the time, the strain at which they occur, so on and so forth. So these are just various ways by which you might try to refine and hone models. And that's the end of the slideshow.
We've done calculations for that last case, and it does show the right qualitative behavior. We just haven't done the right
timescales
time
yet.
Scale, so I'm not anxious to show it in a slide.
Has anyone ever done the calculation for double step strain with these models?
Double step strain.
You mean like in a model with all the bells and whistles sort of thing? I don't think so.
No, not that I know.
I don't believe so.
I'm not sure we changed the track. We must have a good calculation.
And I tried to go as fast as I could. So.
Okay. No problem. Okay.
Thank you. So we just turn this off, right?
Give us some interpretive.
The nice thing about the
biology, got a picture of my family.
You plot a lot of that data, turn it into graphs, and then look at the dynamics. You don't see all the little subtle details that you see in the orientation coming from these birefringers.
Oops.
So if you just made your chance and stress the same flows, it's in there somewhere.
Yeah,
but,
can
you help me with this?
You can't deconvolute the stress measurements and reproduce.
I guess trying to just put it on your belt or something.
I'm going to put it in my pocket. I just want to see whether it's on or not. I don't think it was on in the case. Oh, yeah, it is.
We taped over the switch.
Yeah, it is.
Previously completely anisotropic stuff being picked up and given an orientation angle rather than the relaxation of any
of those changes. The chain basically goes back toward, you know, pushed back toward an isotropic state, and then it, so you could think it either rotates or it goes back and then stretches, and so it goes back and then stretches back out in the other direction. That's why you get that transient. It doesn't rotate. You know, in other words,
Is it for sure that there is stretching in the chain? Yeah. Okay. So this is a little bit different and different spin in the same story. A vast number of practical flows are shear flows. The orthodox way of predicting how shear flows behave is, of course, the constitutive equation approach, the one which was followed yesterday and today. Nevertheless, as we discover, or as we know, we are quite far away from the total answer following the proper constitutive approach. The practitioners need answers, and they need them yesterday. This is a semi-empirical theory using bits and pieces and assembly from the molecular rheology theory and a little bit of intuition to end up with practical answers concerning the shear flow behavior of flexible polymers, of linear architecture, and of star-branched architecture. Which are the players in the story? Of course, the shear rate, which is a measure of the intensity of the flow, the viscosity, which a basic assumption here it is that we model it as a power law of the shear rate. P is the exponent of the stress, shear stress dependence on the shear rate. The first normal stress coefficient, which has a corresponding exponent of Q. K and L are the pre-exponential factors. J is the recoverable compliance. measure of the elasticity of the fluid, and those exponents should never exceed 1 or 2 respectively. By the end of this half an hour, we're going to be able to have an idea, possibly true, of how this pre-exponential factor and exponents depend on the molecular weight, on the molecular weight between entanglements, which is assumed to depend this way in the case of a solvent presence, the temperature, the effective bond length, and the rigidity of the chain represented with this C infinity constant, which is actually the square, the ratio of the bond length of over the actual bond of the effective bond length of over the actual one. I start with presenting you the final product of this talk, which is, let's hide this one, this plot here. It's an abstracted way of the shear rate dependence of the viscosity at different molecular weights. At low enough, so this curve here, it's an isomolecular weight curve at different shear rates. At a low enough molecular weights, we have a Rouse type dynamics of our entangled melt. Even if there is a little bit of solvent inside, there is a linear increase of the viscosity with the molecular weight till we reach at the characteristic molecular weight M sub C, over above which the at low shear rates there is a dramatic increase of the molecular weight of the viscosity with the molecular weight, the 3.4 power. While, and this is the but this doesn't happen forever. For every molecular weight, there is a characteristic shear rate where this proportionality between stress and rate does not hold anymore, and there is a shear thinning. This characteristic rate is 1 over the maximum relaxation time of the linear chain as a whole. And this is well established by molecular theory. Now, the assumption here is that this shear thinning does not go forever. By analogy to the onset rate, there is a high shear rate, which is molecular weight invariant, and equal to the inverse of the relaxation time of an entanglement spacing, where this, this shear thing ceases. And there is a Newtonian behavior recurring at shear rates higher than that. So, the more we go down to the molecular weight, there is a, in this characteristic M sub C rate, we have two shear rates, the onset and the cessation of the shear thinning. These two rates coincide at a molecular weight, at a linear chain of molecular weight M sub C.
The high shear rate viscosity.
The high shear rate viscosity. Thank you. At shear rates above the, this characteristic shear rate, it is assumed here that the viscosity is again described by the Rouse expression, like if this theory, which is for non-entangled melts, is valid even at rates above the, this gamma dot C.
Is there an experimental evidence showing that the power law in the power law region, all molecular weights essentially merge one to another?
You are talking about whether the molecular weight exponent, the exponent of the shear thinning behavior is universal.
The actual position of the viscosity, the actual position of the viscosity.
You mean whether this, this overlap if we see, absolutely. And this, an instinctive way of explaining this is the principle of the rate concentration, of the rate dilution superposition principle, where you can, you could replace this, this thing with N. with z rather, the molecular weight, the number of entanglements per chain. If you replot this gamma dot times relaxation time and divide this with the relaxation time of a melt at different solutions, in other words, you have a multi-z plot of the same polymer, then you have a collapse of all these lines into one line.
Crystal, that's not what people are saying. People are saying that all the data they've ever seen does not support the drawing that you have up there.
In which respect?
In lots of
absolute viscosity versus absolute shear rate at the same temperature, but different molecular weight. They start at different levels, of course.
Yes.
But in the shear thinning regimes, they approach a common line.
This happens, this is exactly the case, first of all, as I'm going to try to persuade you later, this is indeed the case at the transitional molecular weight. First of all, this happens in star polymers. Whenever there is branching, I show that this is the case, and that's where most of the data on Newtonian rheology shows, like the Lounge data on low-density polyethylene, it shows this convergence. In this theory also, in a transitional state, which I chose not to speak about here, at approximately between M sub C and a little over M sub C prime, which is the characteristic time where the compliance becomes molecular weight dependent, there is again a transitional state where the shear thinning exponent increases from a zero value into a finite value. But from what I argue here is that above, at well-entangled chains, linear chains, because this never happens in branched chains, there is an invariance of the shear thinning exponent with the molecular weight, provided we are talking about a single molecular weight melt. Okay? Thanks for... So, if we are to see the same picture in ISO shear rate, in ISO what? In ISO shear rate, ISO shear rate curves, we are accustomed with seeing a viscosity versus molecular weight increasing linearly up to a characteristic molecular weight M sub C, where entanglements start to form, and which is double the molecular weight between entanglements, and then is the steep 3.4 increase. New here is the variation, is the difference between the actual and empirical and still an unexplained molecular weight dependence of the zero viscosity from the Dezens Doy Edwards exponent of 3. So,
sorry, it's not unexplained.
Okay. The deviation explained with contour length fluctuations. And what I argue here is that for every shear rate, there is a characteristic molecular weight beyond which there is a recurrence of the linear dependence of the viscosity with the molecular weight. Something similar happens with the compliance versus molecular weight. There is a characteristic molecular weight beyond which there is an invariance of the compliance with the molecular weight. I argue here that even in this case, there is a characteristic rate beyond which there is a recurrence of the linear relationship of the compliance with the molecular weight, as we had before. The point of this presentation here is to fill up the gaps, making these pictures more quantitative in terms of finding the pre-exponentials and the exponents.
Just to make a connection with what other people do, is it fair to say that your critical rate is inverse of tau e rather than you reach the tau e?
The tie, why it's not 1 over tau Rouse, you mean?
No, I'm just asking for clarification. Yeah. It appears to be 1 over tau, is that correct?
The rate where you have recurrence, the high rate where you have recurrence of the Newtonian behavior is the super high rate where the most difficult last entanglement to abandon the chain has to we used in order to strip it from that entanglement. Okay? The most difficult entanglement is the entanglement of a chain end to a neighbor. And this is approximately of length a mi. So it has to be okay? Hurry to go for lunch. Okay, that's the physical explanation. The practical explanation is that I tried first the Rouse relaxation time as the maximum and didn't come up right. So there's a trial and error effort here. So we're going. We don't forget that the molecular origin of nonlinear viscoelasticity is the reversible loss of network connectivity as the intensity of deformation increases. Here's some equations for the characteristic rates and relaxation times associated with them. Apropos, Rouse time is independent of the concentration with respect to the friction coefficient. That's for SCAT. And why it's believable that the relaxation time is independent, or the Rouse relaxation time is independent of concentration. Because if the Z, as I argued a week ago, can be independent of concentration, then okay, we discuss that later. I may be wrong on that. I'm talking about solutions. So the strategy here is we have this plot to the left. We know where to start from. It's like taking this ruler. We know where to start from. We didn't know where to stop, but if we knew that, we would draw this and interpolate between these two points. When you turn this geometric argument into equations, you start with a general expression for the shear thinning, which is like this. Right away, you end up with an expression for the, you make it pass through the rate of the onset of the nonlinearities. Right away, you solve for the factor of the non-Newtonian viscosity. It's not a finished story because you still have to find the exponent. You go to the next page, and you fill up this general enough equation for the high rate, which is one of tau e. I didn't know that they call it tau e, or I didn't remember it. So, oh no, I did. Here, this is it. You plug in the molecular weight dependencies of whatever is left and right. You solve for the, you try to make the exponent consistent left and right, and you end up that with a result which says that the shear thinning exponent of the for linear solutions, polymer solutions and melts, is 1 over the exponent of the molecular weight dependence of the zero shear viscosity for this same material. And not a very hopeful result. If you repeat that work for the normal stress coefficient, for in that transitional state where I told you that we have a progression of the exponent from molecular weight dependence of the exponent, it is approximately 2 times the exponent of the stress, but when it stabilizes the story, then it is 3 times the exponent of the normal stress exponent is 3 times the exponent of the shear stress. And the story told so far is that it is more closer to the double the exponent of the shear stress. And this, of course, is not a nice thing, but I stick with it. The amazing thing is that and behold, you can turn those two expressions, the expression for the shear stress and the normal stress, into one thing. This is it. Shear stress, or half the normal stress, is given by this expression, which involves the following thing. The following things, besides, of course, the friction dependence, the dissipative part. The number of effective bonds per molecule, that is the molecular weight, the number of effective bonds per entanglement, that is the M sub B, and the concentration of a polymer in the case of a solvent presence. Epsilon, this is the exponent in the most general case. R is either the normal stress or the shear stress exponent, depending on which way you want to use this expression. And it affects the concentration dependence as well as the epsilon, which is the how much do you have to add to the 1 over phi dependence of the molecular weight between entanglements, and the mu, the 0.5 that is that you have to add in order to account for chain fluctuations to the 3 exponent of the original reputation theory. Okay. We plug in plausible numbers, 0.25 for the epsilon, 0.5 for this, and we find that the viscosity at the well entangled solutions or melts of single molecular weight decays with a 0.714 power of the shear rate, which is exactly what is the value tabulated in Vinogradov's compilation classic rheology book, and that the normal stress coefficient decays with a 1.14 shear rate, and that the compliance as well as the molecular weight between entanglements is shear rate dependent, although a little faster, a little stronger than what the very scant linear data suggest, which is around 0.2. This expression is also consistent with the rate temperature and the rate concentration superposition principle, which I just explained. It's not surprising to find that the molecular weight dependence in the non-Newtonian regime is weaker than in the Newtonian regime. Also, if we want to decrease the number of parameters by 1, by accepting the belief that both the entanglement molecular weight is chain stiffness dependent, and adding chipping in our own effort to find a corresponding correlation based on reason for the friction coefficient, and accepting plausible again values for the exponents as well as the dilution laws. These are the laws for the stiffness dependence of the molecular weight between entanglements, or the M sub C for that matter. This is for the friction coefficient. You plug everything in, and you end up with these expressions for the viscosity coefficient and for the first normal stress coefficient, which actually in the paper, for which I have made 4 copies, and they are somewhere in the next room, because these 2 rooms were connected in the beginning of the talk. Is also for the I have also expressions for the general and a peak and Q. In other words, you don't have to believe my story for this in order to use this. And from this, staring at these 2 expressions, you realize that you can declare a law which says that the stress coefficient of a polymer with a higher rigidity is as a rule lower in value than that of the more flexible species. While if you work in a similar way the diffusion coefficient, you end up with the opposite rule, that this is almost zero dependence on stiffness, so forget this, that because this is so sensitive to the chain stiffness, the stiffer the polymer, the more hard to diffuse. Is that what it is? Now I can't figure it out because I'm running out of time, but it's the opposite trend. Now, these are all results which were published and with good comments from the referees and the editor. What it is now under review, I sent it for the first time a few days before I traveled here, is the corresponding story for star branch polymers, no internal branches of the pom-pom type. The general result is not surprisingly the same like before. What is different here is that the exponent, as Pino suggested, is not even in the well-entangled case, is not universal. It depends on the number of entanglements per arm, very sensitively, and never going to an asymptotic form. And never going to an asymptotic form, even for practical reasons, because you can never go, unlike in linear case, in the linear polymers more than 20, 30 years, or you end up with a virtual solid. You can never go with Z, or A, as I call it here, much more than a few decades. So that's the novelty here, along with the fact that the square dependence of normal stresses on shear stresses is theoretically, into quotes, verified for this branched case, and also the shear rate invariance of the elasticity parameter, that is the compliance. And also, because in our case now, in the star case, the shear thinning curves are not anymore shape invariant as we go from high to higher and higher molecular size, the dilution, the concentration, we have to read that, the rate concentration superposition principle fails. Okay. Now, the last view graph in this story is that you can work out a similar. We speak better by exposing an example. We can specify the previous expression for the shear stress and the normal stress in terms of a volume fraction of polymer and the size of arm for a real case, which of course has never been tried in the non-Newtonian flow situation, because I don't know of any well-characterized non-Newtonian star polymers. The only one, the classic data of Laon or Munsted on the low density of Munsted of low density polyethylene, indeed it shows that convergence of flow curves that Pino talked about, but in this case of a polybutadiene tried by Raggio and Al and all at two different compositions, at several different compositions, in the melt case, you have an exponent of shear stress which goes that molecule had 25 entanglements per arm. In the melt case, it grows, the stress grows with a 0.4 power of the shear rate. If you dilute it 40%, if you dilute it in 60% solvent, you go down to a number of entanglements per arm, which is 10, and the shear rate goes to 0.6. If we were dealing with in the zero shear limit, no matter if we were dealing with a diluted or undiluted melt, there's a linear relationship. And with a little more algebra and a little bit more physical thinking, you end up with an expression for the network thinning effect of the shear rate, which shows that the molecular weight between entanglements grows logarithmically with the shear rate. And you can probably dare to speak about diffusion enhancement in the presence of high intensity flow. If you believe that the D star is equal to a diameter movement in a time equal to the total relaxation time of the star, which is now shear rate dependent, and you end up with the following result, that the product of viscosity times diffusivity in the case of stars increases with the shear rate, while the opposite happens in the case of a linear polymer. In both cases, diffusivity increases with shear rate. Now I'm talking about the product between the two. Okay? And that's the end of my story. Thank you. Thank you.